The following program from the North Carolina Reading Service is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. And it's the Indie Week with John Feddersen reading this week, the issue dated August the 6th of 2026. All right, we open at the national implications story. A man from Durham, a Mexican man who's died from leukemia while in ICE custody. A Mexican man, Prisciliano Trejo Ricano, lived in Durham and was in ICE custody. He died at a hospital in Augusta, Georgia, after developing an aggressive form of leukemia that quickly claimed his life. The 29-year-old died at 6 a.m. July 24th, according to information provided to Enlace Latino, North Carolina, by a relative. He was arrested June 19th in the Durham area and transferred to the Stewart Detention Center in Lumpkin, Georgia. So far this year, the deaths of 50 immigrants in ICE custody, including Prisciliano, have been made public. Stefania Arteaga, founder and executive director of Carolina Migrant Network, told Enlace Latino, "We know his family is now grieving. Prisciliano was a young man who came to the United States when he was 3 years old and was detained June 19th. He experienced many medical difficulties while detained, and despite advocating for access to medical care, it was denied until he could no longer endure it." On Saturday, July 24th, Arteaga, along with her organization and other local groups, held a vigil in Charlotte to honor Mexican worker Lorenzo Araujo and Colombian man Juan Sebastian Guerrero, who died 1 week apart on July 7 and July 13th after being shot by ICE agents in Texas and in Maine. During the event, there was an emotional moment when Arteaga read the names of 24 of the 50 immigrants who have died in U.S. ICE detention centers, including Prisciliano, since President Donald Trump took office. During the 3 weeks Prisciliano was held at Stewart, he became seriously ill and called and video called his family every day for emotional support. One of his cousins wrote in a GoFundMe fundraiser to help cover his funeral expenses, quote, "During his time there, he experienced high levels of stress, depression, and physical illness. He told his family on several occasions that he felt sick, was coughing up blood, was in pain, and had a bruise that would not heal." On July 16th, his family received a call from his attorney informing them that Prisciliano had been transferred to this Atlanta hospital and was in the intensive care unit. And he said, "The news devastated the family, and everyone drove between 4 and 5 hours to reach the hospital where he was admitted. At first, the family was not allowed to visit him because Prisciliano was still in ICE custody, but eventually the attorneys in ICE reached an agreement, and he was released from that custody." The cousin added, "It's very difficult to see someone who was almost never sick and was in good health now intubated, connected to intravenous medications, and restrained to a hospital bed while fighting for his life." On July the 10th, the Mexican national turned 29 while in detention and thanked people for their birthday wishes on his Facebook profile, where he also described the difficult situation he was facing. Quote, "Here they treat you like a number or placeholder for the next group of people who come and go. This week I've been dealing with a severe sore throat, coughing up blood in the morning and night, and very intense migraines, and I still have not been treated or given any medication. It's not that I'm holding on tightly through faith and the support of my family, who know about this. That also doesn't mean it's easy. There were days when I cried and felt helpless. This is truly the worst feeling of my life." The young man added, "I pray for the people in this situation because it's not easy. Most of these people aren't even criminals. They're either working or on their way home when they're taken into custody." Next, from Apex, North Carolina, the Apex mayor has questioned fairness and accuracy of the audit of town finances. This winter, when town staff were trying to put together a budget for the current fiscal year, Apex was $6 million in the hole in utility balances. A cyber attack in the summer of 2024 meant the town had to reconfigure its billing systems, and customers were receiving combined 2- and 3-month utility bills, which, along with annual rate increases, caused confusion over higher payments. The town had paused late fee collections and service disconnections, but the situation was becoming untenable. About 15% of customers had foregone paying their bills entirely. The financial stability of Apex Electric Utilities was compromised, and the town's credit rating was threatened. Mayor Pro Tem Terry Mahaffey, in February 26th email to constituents, said, quote, "There is concern that if we don't soon make it clear we do intend to collect on unpaid balances, one could argue we would be in violation of the covenants on some utility bonds we've borrowed," meaning the bondholders could demand immediate payment in full, which would be ruinous. Apex announced it would resume normal billing, including collecting late fees and disconnecting utility service for non-payment, on July 1st of this year. It offered interest-free payment plans to all customers and payment assistance to some. Meanwhile, an annual audit of the town's finances, made public at the end of May, suggests an elected official was one of the utility account holders who, at some point, had owed the town money, and for seemingly long enough, or an amount high enough, that it came to an outside examiner's attention. On June 25th, according to public records obtained by Indy, Apex town manager Randy Vosberg wrote an email to John Griffin, the town's finance director, about a phone call from Apex Mayor Jacques Gilbert to one of the town's external auditors. Vosberg wrote, "Do you think I need or should reach out to them? I'm still digesting the nature of his contact. Did they say he was seeking clarification, or was it more questioning than the findings? Was it just on the P-card transactions and wage garnishing comments? Anything else you remember? Trying to decide if there is any action I need to follow up with, or if I need to discuss anything with council or mayor." This was Randy Vosberg, town manager. The town of Apex had, just 1 month prior, received a clean audit opinion from the firm Cherry Bickert for the 2025 fiscal year, which covers July 1, 2024 to July 1, 2025, but the auditors had flagged three issues known as financial performance indicators of concern in their report and the presentation of their findings to the town council. The first point of concern was that the town's own internal audit was submitted to Cherry Bickert late. The second was that the town, quote, "did not always comply with its policies," unquote, on the use and review of procurement cards, or P cards, essentially credit cards issued to town staff or elected officials. The third point of concern was that the town did not comply with the state law mandating that municipalities garnish the wages of elected officials who owed the town money for its services. The day after this audit presentation to the council, Griffin emailed all council members and the mayor with Cherry Bickert's findings. He noted the report was sent to the Local Government Commission, LGC, in the State Treasurer's Office for review, and to the credit rating agencies that maintain Apex's bond ratings. The next morning, Gilbert emailed Vosberg to ask about the process of, quote, "presenting questions and challenging possible inaccurate information to the audit firm," according to public records obtained by Indy, citing language from the auditor's report about the firm's responsibilities. Gilbert questioned Cherry Bickert's process for carrying out the audit, though he was not so specific about any concerns. He wrote, Based on the process of how this is done every year, there is a meeting set up with the audit firm, with the mayor, and questions are presented. I don't recall the process being completed in the same manner as in with previous years. In those years, the audit firm would present any questions or concerns to me. I think this is even more important as we paid this firm with an expectation of fair and accurate service, the email concluded. While the auditor's report did not specify what town service had gone unpaid by an elected official, emails obtained by Indy and the town's written response to the audit point to unpaid utility bills. According to Griffin's response to Vosburgh's June 25th email, Gilbert's phone call to the lead auditor, Lee Ann Waters, occurred on June 23rd. In his email, Griffin relayed to Vosburgh that Waters called to touch base with him about a half hour after speaking with the mayor. Quote, Griffin wrote on June 30th, Lee Ann said he specifically was inquiring about concerns about the unpaid utility bill note, questioning why it was presented, giving the general policy, whether it was appropriate, and I believe questioning what elected officials it applied to. Waters, though, did not respond to an email requesting comment from Indy. Griffin said the mayor also brought up, quote, concerns about the P-card disclosure, concern that the note presentation implied wrongdoing or inappropriate activity. The mayor also asked about, quote, the lateness of the audit, whether the staff and public explanations provided for the completion of it were accurate, and she said she provided the same explanations consistent with what were on the LGC paperwork and discussed at the meetings. Griffin added the mayor wanted to know specifically what the auditors looked at and questioned how the financial performance indicators of concern were brought to their attention. He said the mayor asked Waters for a document explaining those points, to which Waters responded, quote, it would be inappropriate for Cherry Becker to put anything more in writing than they already had with their official opinion letters, according to Griffin, who concluded by stating Waters directed Gilbert back to the town since town staff already had to prepare a response document for LGC. He said he hasn't heard from her since. Apex's P-card policy has come under scrutiny recently, and town staff are currently working on a new policy governing P-card usage that's expected to go before the town council soon. While some town staff members have or had access to P-cards, Indy reported in October that out of all the town council members, only the mayor had access to a P-card. While the auditors noted the town did not always comply with its own policies regarding P-card usage, they did not specify who or if any staff member or elected official was misusing a P-card. Still, an analysis of Gilbert's P-card purchases since 2024 showed some questionable spending on the mayor's part, including $375 to a porta-potty company, $343 to a local arts and crafts store, $402 to a hotel in Wilmington, $600 to a Hilton hotel, and hundreds of dollars to local restaurants. Gilbert, who is paid about $22,000 annually as mayor and receives a monthly stipend of $319 from the town, defended his purchases by saying the town's policies were unclear. He has also stated publicly that he never asked for a P-card. Instead, one was given to him by the town clerk when he first took office in 2019, he said. Quote, there is no process. There's never been a process to what they're talking about, he told the Indy about the P-card policy. Now, Gilbert did not respond emails Indy requesting an interview for this story. In a November email to the town clerk, an administrator in Apex's finance department confirmed that Gilbert's card was suspended. It's also likely that Gilbert is the elected official who owed money to the town during the 2025 fiscal year. While he did not respond to an email from Indy asking him to confirm, if accurate, that he never owed money to the town for services during his tenure, four of his colleagues did. former council members Brett Gant and Audra Killingsworth, and current members Terry Mahaffey and Arno Zagerman all confirmed in writing that they never owed money to the town while in office or during the 25 fiscal year. Councilmember Ed Gray was the only other elected official who did not respond to the Indy's inquiry. Following the fallout from the cyber attack, Gilbert's colleagues on the council criticized him publicly for spreading misinformation about the town's billing operations on social media. Gilbert called the billing operations a, quote, crisis, and continued to post about it on social media for months after the town had gotten a handle on the issue by transitioning to a new billing system in July of 25 and replacing outdated water and electric meters. A third-party review in October of 25 found that most utilities customers in Apex had been underbilled, with $33.46 being the highest amount a customer was overbilled, and $12.05 being the average amount customers were overbilled. Average amount. Still, the mayor continued to insist the situation was, quote, not yet fully resolved, and some residents continued not to pay their bills. Gilbert wrote in a Facebook post on March 22nd, Apex, I've received many emails and calls regarding utility bills that appear inaccurate, unusually high, and accompanied by advanced due dates. Upon opening my own bill, I see mine is unusually higher than average as well. On July 22nd, town staff drafted a response to the independent auditor's findings. According to North Carolina's administrative code, a municipality is required to submit a signed response to the LGC when an independent auditor identifies deficiencies in the audit, including any financial performance indicators of concern. The document, which was shared with Indy this week, is addressed to the LGC's secretary, Denise Canada, and distributed to the mayor and council for them to sign. On July 28th, Gilbert was the second-to-last member of the council to sign the document. Councilmember Arno Zagerman signed it the next day, and it was sent. In the document, the town lays out its reasons for being late to submit its internal audit, not complying with its P-card usage policy, and not complying with the state statute requiring towns to garnish the wages of elected officials who haven't paid for town services. The cybersecurity attack created challenges that delayed access to financial information and hindered financial staff's ability to prepare and audit statements from the previous fiscal year, explained the town. The town transitioned to this new accounting system in January of 25, says the document, requiring data conversions that later required corrections. The town also saw turnover in both its finance director in April 25 and its assistant finance director in August. But the town has been, quote, fully restaffed in its accounting and reporting functions, states the documents, and has since dedicated money to support year-end financial reporting. Quote, the town is confident that staffing stability and appropriate investments in report writing will improve the timeliness of future annual comprehensive financial reports, both to the town's citizens and to the commission. Regarding the P-card usage policy, the town again cited turnover in the finance department and changes to its financial control environment, including a system transition that impacted its ability to administer P-card transactions. Quote, as a result, the town's finance department could not carry out certain written procedures required by policy, the document states, including the suspending of privileges. Quote, the town has since tightened restrictions and is more uniformly enforcing the policy and additionally is preparing a revised policy document that better reflects the town's commitment to internal control and current software. Regarding the utilities non-payment, the town in the document cites its moratorium on applying late fees and disconnections for unpaid balances, and it states This policy was applied broadly to all customers without penalties in effect. Enforced collections were not flagged or applied in the town's billing system, leading to the oversight of the state law. The document notes that the finance director is working on developing a procedure to comply with the law. But the document notes, as of the date of this letter, there are no amounts of unpaid monies due to the town from its elected officials for town services. To Morrisville, or to everybody place but Morrisville, Western Wake bus rapid transit route will bypass that town. Picture 60-foot orange buses zooming westward towards Research Triangle Park, unimpeded by traffic. If all goes according to plan, by 2035, bus rapid transit, BRT, will connect downtown Raleigh to RTP via downtown Cary, making a couple dozen stops along the way. Dedicated bus-only lanes, traffic signal prioritization, and off-board ticketing will make the trips faster than normal bus service. Western Wake commuters rejoice. The only losers in this scenario, arguably, are the residents of Morrisville, a densely packed town where traffic is becoming a quality of life issue, who won't have easy access to BRT because the planned route mostly circumvents their town. The Morrisville Town Council grappled with this disappointing reality at its work session last week. Councilmember Vicki Scroggins-Johnson lamented it's bringing people from out of Morrisville through to RTP instead of benefiting the Morrisville population. The total capital cost of the Western Extension is estimated at $62 million. About $18 million of that will come from a special half-cent sales tax levied by Wake County for transit projects. North Carolina has committed $20 million more, leaving a funding gap of $24 million. Councilmember Liz Johnson says our residents are paying for all this, and yet they're not getting a benefit, referencing this sales tax. By the end of the meeting, the council had agreed to write a letter to the Triangle's Regional Transit Planning Organization, KEMPO, short for Capital Area Metropolitan Planning Organization, expressing their qualms with the Western Extension alignment. They don't expect or even want the letter to change KEMPO's plan to formally approve the alignment as it's at its September 16th board meeting, but they're making this gesture on their residents' behalf. Rather than passing directly through Morrisville via Chapel Hill Road or Davis Drive, two routes that were considered, it cuts a jagged arc around the town on the northeast side via Evans Road. It's obvious why Morrisville's leaders would be frustrated not to be included in Wake County's most promising regional public transport effort to date. But as the work session made clear, there are a few solid reasons why this alignment was chosen. 1. KEMPO chose this route years ago and avoided Morrisville's main thoroughfares by design. The fact the Western Extension skirts around Morrisville is not a new revelation. KEMPO has planned to put a BRT line between Cary and RTP since 2018, and the agency landed on the Evans Road alignment in 23 because it struck the best balance between attracting riders and minimizing travel times. As Morrisville's representative on KEMPO board, Morrisville Mayor T.J. Cawley has been able to watch the planning process unfold. And he said, "This is a point-to-point route. This is really Raleigh to Cary to RTP. This isn't designed necessarily to be a local route for our residents." Adding more BRT stops would slow down travel times, defeating the purpose of conveying commuters quickly from point A to point B, Cawley explained. 2, Morrisville may not be ready for BRT. Brett Martin, Morrisville's transportation project manager, said during this work session, the town hasn't yet shown enough demand for public transport to justify a BRT route. Morrisville has a population of about 30,000 inside a 10-square-mile area. At the moment, its only public transit option is the Smart Shuttle. That is an app based on-demand service that takes riders between 17 stops around town. It's a small-scale operation. The shuttle only seats 19 passengers. According to Martin, the natural next step in expanding Morrisville's public transit offerings would be a fixed-route bus system, similar to Go Raleigh and Go Cary. Martin said, it's really, really hard to be like, we're just going to do BRT. And you haven't done any seeding of the market. You haven't done any evaluation of where people really want to get on and where they're going, origins and destinations. We really need to get that fixed route service going first, and then we can build up from there to BRT. Martin pointed out a few of the current Smart Shuttle stops, including Park West Village, Perimeter Park, and Wake Tech's RTP campus, overlap with planned BRT stops, which could help Morrisville residents access BRT more easily. Number three, Morrisville residents will get a benefit from the Western Extension, albeit a secondary one. Cawley noted Western Extension will take cars off the roads, which will improve commute times for everyone. Quote, even if people aren't on the buses, they benefit, because some people are on the buses, so we're taking the car off the roads. 4. Launching a more forceful protest against the Evans alignment could risk delaying or derailing the Western Extension altogether. Cawley said if you change routes, you lose funding, you lose credibility as a planning body. Worse still, warned Martin, Campo could decide to move its investment elsewhere if there isn't local consensus around this Western Extension. Quote, Campo does take very seriously when the governing body of a municipality that's impacted by such an investment is not in favor of it. The money that's allocated for this could totally be taken and put somewhere else. If it were a choice between this, BRT alignment, or nothing at all, what would your choice be? After some back and forth, the town council seemed to reach an agreement, Mayor Pro Tem and Roboti, summing up the thrust of their discussion, we understand this is a regional project. I believe we're united, that we'd rather have this than nothing, but we have a responsibility to our residents, too. Apex plans to close a volunteer-built downtown fire station. A retired firefighter is leading a campaign to keep it open. This is Apex Fire Station 1, and it has been an unofficial historic landmark on the town's main downtown thoroughfare since volunteers built it brick and mortar back in 1954. With the aging building unable to accommodate modern operations, town officials say it will close, and the demolition of the original building, in whole or in part, is probable. Retired firefighter Roy Moore is trying to rescue it. Moore is organizing a grassroots movement complete with press release, media interviews, and a petition titled Save Apex Fire Station 1 from Demolition, that has reached over 1,200 signatures. Moore said it is the heart of the small-town character here of downtown Apex, this fire station is, gesturing to the station behind him from the red and black bench out front. He served as a volunteer and staff firefighter at Station 1 for a total of 22 years from 1998 to 2020. And believes the highly trafficked location helps residents connect with first responders. Not only does Moore think the station should remain operational, but he wants to integrate a museum and fire prevention center in the original bays that cannot fit modern fire trucks. Town manager Randy Vosburgh, too, hopes that whatever the site becomes next is an homage to the firefighters who served the community all those years. The town council also indicated back in 2024 it could be a museum and educational center. While the town has already decided the station will cease operation in the next few years, no final call about the site's future has been made. At its August 11 meeting, the council is expected to vote on funding for a feasibility study, which would bring in consultants and community members to explore the site's future. Though not a designated landmark, Fire Station 1 is revered by many residents, recognized for generations of professional and volunteer firefighters who put their lives on the line for their community and molded the Apex Fire Department into what it is today. The three-bay brick firehouse downtown saw multiple additions as the department expanded and modernized. Two more bays were added to the left side of the original building in 1961. Two long drive-through bays were added in the 1970s, and other structural additions, including its second story, were layered over the years. In 2002, Fire Station 3 came into the picture, less than a mile away on Hunter Street. The town's website states 1 and 3 now essentially function as one station in two separate buildings, and that Station 3 provides the space required for operations and personnel to accommodate a growing community. Modern efforts to figure out what to do with the downtown area, including Station 1 and other projects just coming to fruition now, began back in 2019. At the time, town council members were not in favor of remodeling Station 1, but indicated they wanted to maintain a fire presence downtown. Later that year, the council adopted the Downtown Master Plan, which was formed with public input, along with other projects like the completed Saunders parking lot, the in-progress Salem streetscape, and the future alleys and peak gathering space. It called for Fire Station 1 to be reimagined as a new civic or mixed-use site. In 24, the town council reviewed a few proposed ideas for Apex's fire stations and eventually expressed support for moving all Station 1 operations to Station 3 and redeveloping 1 into an educational center on Apex Fire. The town also reviewed a fire station location study in May of 25 that supported closing Station 1, renovating 3, and moving Station 1's engine and crew to Station 3. The main drivers were the station's largely overlapping response areas and Station 1's inability to accommodate modern fire operations. The design of 3's renovation received funding in the budget adopted later that year. This year's budget funds the actual construction, which will tentatively begin in December. While no final call about demolition will be made pending a study on Station 1, Vosburg said Apex is considering what a 2019 assessment found. It would take millions of dollars to bring the building up to code and make it a functioning space because the building's basic structure is poor. It was built by volunteers over 70 years ago, and because the original building was repeatedly pieced together with new additions over the years, that inevitably makes renovations challenging, inefficient, and expensive. He also said the station's location is inconvenient, given the road network is more difficult for fire trucks to navigate, as opposed to Station 3's less pedestrian traffic location over on Hunter Street. Additionally, whenever there's a parade downtown, Station 1 units have to be relocated due to street closures. Vosburg says, Apex Fire wants what's best for the firefighters going forward, and what's best for the firefighters going forward is a modernized station that has all the anti-cancer protection, has the washing bays, has all of those things, and it's very cost prohibitive to do that there, if at all possible. This is not a decision to walk away from Station 1 or what it represents, said Apex Fire Chief Tim Herman in a social media statement. It is a strategic decision about how we provide the best emergency coverage possible for a growing community while remaining responsible stewards of town resources. Elmore wants to see Station 1 remain an operating one. He also proposed, similarly to the town, coupling historic preservation with a contemporary utility by adding a museum and fire prevention center, which could be the foundation of a compromise. But Moore insists the station should remain in operation. His sudden public campaign could seem like the makings of a bid for office, which Moore said he has considered, but he's, quote, not ready to commit at this time. Moore serves as treasurer of the Rotary Club of Apex, which also hosts its annual pancake breakfast in the station. And he said, this station, the interaction with the community, the guys down here, is priceless. You just don't see that elsewhere, and I don't think it's a compromise situation. Council member and Mayo Pro Tempore Terry Mahaffrey told Indy that while the town wants to make it clear no decision has been made to demolish Station 1, the town will probably have to demolish and rebuild at least some of the building, while hopefully preserving salvageable parts to maintain the station's character. Station 1, said Vosburgh, does not officially qualify as a historic building and therefore does not require preservation. Mahaffey said, if I had to guess, I would say it'll be in between a renovation or a teardown. We don't want to remove the site entirely, but it may require a very, very deep amount of work to get it up to code and to be usable today. Ensuring new developments match the look of older, shorter buildings that characterize Salem Street has been a concern of residents, especially after the modern three-story High Line was built across the street from Fire Station 1. Mahaffey said that because the town owns the station, there isn't the same commercial pressure to make a development project viable. The 2019 Downtown Master Plan included three conceptual images of what a new Fire Station 1 site with some sort of alternative civic use could look like. While managing some symbolic elements of the original, they appear similar in style to the contentious High Line. Moore said these renderings don't look like the station, and the design just doesn't settle with him. He launched his petition on July 20th and has since kept up a Save Apex Fire Station 1 Facebook page to rally support. At the August meeting, Moore plans to bring his crew to present testimonies on the station's cultural value gathered through their efforts during the public comment period. For now, the council will only decide whether to fund the feasibility study, not the fate of the station. Moore said, this is emotion, raw emotion here in Apex of what people are telling us. The director for Apex Economic Development, Joanna Helms, said Station 1 study the council will vote on will take about 9 months to complete, including public input. Mahaffey estimated the town would pick a specific direction for the site around 2030. Helms says she hopes Moore's advocacy efforts drive more engagement with the study process. She said, what's kind of cool in a backhanded way is because of this effort by Roy and his group, this is even given more attention to the study that's coming up. Well, for some, all these reportings of governmental, let's say, contentiousness or debate or inability to get along, this article, which I have saved for a couple of weeks, is called Sweet Dreams, spelled S-U-I-T-E. On July 2nd, North Carolina's Republican-controlled legislature announced that it had finally passed its first budget in 3 years, making it the last state in the nation to do so for months. No one in the legislature, not even members of the same party, seemed capable of finding common ground. State House and Senate leaders bickered over specific funding priorities, such as a children's hospital in Apex, and the scope of government job cuts. The wait was both painful for state employees and a testament to the widespread feeling that government simply does not work for anyone anymore. But there was a time when the state's legislators, no matter how ideologically opposed, did work together. They passed large spending programs and found ways to bridge at least some of the gaps between liberals and conservatives on major controversies. It likely helped that, for almost half of the 20th century, many of them stayed in the same Raleigh hotel. The Sir Walter Hotel in downtown was the epicenter of North Carolina politics for over four decades. It not only hosted important political speeches, campaign events, and lobbying meetings from the 20s through the 70s, but it was also the site of countless secret backroom deals. If you were a legislator who wanted to gerrymander a district, for example, you knew where to go. Phil Carlton, former state Supreme Court justice and longtime political operative, said recently, "Everybody understood the laws got made at night around a poker game in someone's room at the Sir Walter. This was just an accepted way to do it." In the 1920s, Raleigh's civic boosters, including editor and publisher Josephus Daniels of the News and Observer, had a problem. Most business convention traffic flowed to larger cities like Greensboro and Durham, rather than staying in the capital, which was then only the fifth largest city in the state. Their proposed solution, a brand new skyscraper hotel, complete with private baths and telephones, that would attract business travelers and host a wide variety of events. Completed in 1924 for roughly $900,000, the Sir Walter, as it was known, featured arched window openings, egg and dart molding, and a three-part structure with a base, middle, and ornate cap like a Greek column. Later, it would become the first North Carolina hotel to have central air conditioning. Sitting 10 stories high at 400 Fayetteville Street, the Sir Walter was only 3 blocks from the state capitol. Within a few months, the hotel had become the unofficial headquarters of the legislature, housing up to 80% of lawmakers during the sessions. They lived, ate meals together, and held daily meetings in its conference rooms. By 1957, U.S. Senator Sam Ervin Jr. was calling the Sir Walter the most politically saturated inn in America. That much concentrated political power was bound to attract lobbyists, which Sir Walter did in great numbers. In room 215, politicos helped themselves to the steady supply of alcohol provided by the state's liquor lobby, which remained a haven for parties until 1957, when a News and Observer expose led to the seizure of 9 cases of liquor. Other lobbyist rooms, such as one for a trucking organization in the early 60s, became the new sources for legislators looking for a drink. With liquor flowing freely to powerful men, many of whom were living hours away from their wives, prostitution flourished. The authorities often ignored it, but for a brief period during the Second World War, they decided to crack down. On August 19, 1942, a Mrs. C. F. Wirtz was sentenced to 8 months in prison for using a hotel for immoral purposes. Perhaps the most dramatic moment in the history of Sir Walter came during the 1950 U.S. Senate primary, when Willis Smith ran against Frank Porter Graham to be North Carolina's Democratic Party nominee that year. Graham was repeatedly spat on across the state. Smith's forces mercilessly attacked Graham, the incumbent and a former UNC Chapel Hill president, as a communist for his opposition to Jim Crow and his belief in economic equality. The vitriol extended to campaign workers as well, with one Graham worker imploring the candidate to come and take all your literature out of my house. My neighbors won't talk to me. It was one of the most contentious races in the state's history, with one side embracing civil rights and modernity, while the other clung to segregation and the past. Yet no matter how wide the ideological gulf was between Graham and Smith, the physical distance between them was next to zero. Both campaigns were headquartered at the Sir Walter, with Graham on the 6th floor, Smith on the 1st. Every day, opposing staff passed each other in the hallways and ate in the same dining room. On the night of the primary runoff, which Smith narrowly won, Graham was forced to walk by his opponent and shake his hand as he left. His dejected supporters had to sneak by Smith's whooping advocates. A former aide to Terry Sanford, Tom Lambeth, said the hotel remained busy, even outside of election night. If you came to Raleigh, you just stayed at the Sir Walter. During the 1960 presidential campaign, when Kennedy and Johnson vied for the Democratic nomination, both candidates and the eager Kennedy surrogate, Harry S. Truman, stayed at Sir Walter. Lambeth often heard stories of tense meetings in the lobby and flirtatious dalliances in the dining room. It was no wonder the hotel was often referred to as the third house of government. But the state's black citizens couldn't access their representatives at the Sir Walter, which was segregated. In 1963, civil rights protesters staged a check-in, a sit-in in the lobby with suitcases. Sanford, who was one of the few governors who did not base his campaign out of the hotel, responded by meeting with the protesters and listening to their demands. According to Carlton, Sanford and other liberals worked out of the nearby Carolina Hotel in order to avoid confrontations like the one during Graham Smith. While not immediately successful in its goal of segregating the hotel, the Sir Walter protest shone extra light on racial discrimination across Raleigh. By then, the Sir Walter statue as a political hub had started to wane. The legislative building, which featured much larger meeting and conference rooms, opened in 1963. And as more people moved to the post-World War suburbs and traveled the interstate's centralized downtowns, including Raleigh's, declined nationwide. Without steady bookings and revenue, the hotel was harder to maintain. More important was another factor, the Vietnam War. Multiple shocking political assassinations, the explosive 68 Democratic Convention, and the Watergate scandal shattered the public's trust in its leaders. Backroom dealings were no longer tolerated, at least not openly. The new generation of politicians who promoted fair primaries and political transparency diminished the strength of old-fashioned power brokers. Well, the Sheraton Hotel chain took over Sir Walter in 1968 and tried, unsuccessfully, to revive its reputation. Blanche Manor, who wrote a gossip column for the News and Observer, lived there for a time, greeting guests and attending social events into her 90s. The hotel changed ownership multiple times after that, but efforts to attract business eventually fizzled out. Finally, in 1978, the building was converted into affordable housing units for seniors, and it was added to the National Register of Historic Places that same year. Some state leaders shifted their operations to the Raleigh Hilton Inn on Hillsborough Street. Others went to the Governor's Inn in Research Triangle Park. Neither of these places worked as well as in the heyday of the Sir Walter, which benefited from both its elegance and its proximity. Today, Raleigh's oldest surviving hotel building continues to evolve. In 2019, Capital Realty Group, a New York firm, purchased Sir Walter for almost $17 million and began renovations in the basement. Maintenance workers soon discovered what appeared to be a Prohibition-era speakeasy. When Anthony Rapillo, a local restaurateur, heard about that, he committed himself to reviving it as an underground cocktail bar, which he plans to call the Third House by the end of 2026. They had their normal meetings upstairs, but I'm sure this is where many of the secret deals were made, he said, of the building's political past. While that's good news for the Sir Walter, there is no longer any single hotel headquarters for either Democrats or Republicans in North Carolina. The past five governors have used four different locations for their victory parties, with Roy Cooper recently opting for a convention center at NC State, and Josh Stein choosing Marriott City Center. With state politics as divided as ever, it's hard to remember the days when politicians came together if for no other reason than to indulge in the same overnight vices. And I may have time for most of this article, which is also saved from a few weeks ago. A night out at Easy Street. The teenager who arrived at Easy Street that summer did not look like a future guitar legend, Michael Ross said. He was just a real kid, brave, his cap on, wide-eyed, showing off the van's mobile TV and his Sega. His name was Derek Trucks, and he was 12 years old. Today, Trucks is widely regarded as one of the finest slide guitarists of his generation, a musician whose career has included the Allman Brothers Band, the Tedeschi Trucks Band, and multiple Grammy Awards. But in 1992, he was just a teenager from Jacksonville, Florida, arriving in downtown Raleigh to play a small club on East Harget Street. That club, Easy Street Cafe, and the booking itself came together with a kind of casual spontaneity that would come to define the venue. Ross, who assisted in booking bands at Easy Street, said, I put my hand over the phone and said, Mom, do we want Butch Trucks' nephew to come play slide guitar at the bar? She said, is Butch going to come? No, Mom, Butch is not going to come. And she said, that's all right, have him come anyway. At the time, there was no reason to think the show would become a footnote in American music history, but Trucks was one of many musicians who passed through Easy Street during its short existence. Colonel Bruce Hampton and the Aquarium Rescue Unit played there. Peter Rowan, Doc Watson came through. American saxophonist Maceo Parker, accompanied by the J.B. Horns, performed. One night, John Prine unexpectedly walked through the door. For a brief period in the early 1990s, opening in 91 and closing 21 months later, a club that many Raleigh residents have never heard of managed to attract an outsized collection of talent. The timing makes the story even stranger. When Trucks stepped onto the Easy Street stage, downtown Raleigh had not yet become the entertainment district people know today. King's was years away. Slim's wouldn't open for 7 more years. Lincoln Theater, then operating as a bar and internet cafe, has not yet emerged as a downtown music anchor. Much of Fayetteville Street remained dead after business hours. Andrew Brown, a local musician who grew up in Raleigh, said, downtown Raleigh had not come back to life yet. The Fayetteville Street Mall at night was a ghost town. All you heard was the cuckoo of the crosswalks for the blind. But somehow, in the middle of that silence, Easy Street found an audience. If the guest list seems surprising, its origins were just as remarkable. Owners Jim Bob Kreitz, Deidre Shipman, and Victoria Carr met through Raleigh's counterculture scene at Sadlock's on Hillsborough Street. None of them had ever owned a music venue, but convinced the city needed something aside from the loud dive bars they frequented, the trio took a leap of faith, handling all venue operations, from cleaning the toilets to working the bar and running sound. Shipman recalled, we provided the dream and the sweat equity. Kreitz handled the books, inventory, and day-to-day operations. Shipman booked acts and cultivated relationship with touring musicians. Carr managed front-of-house experience while helping shape the club's identity. Her daughter, Rainbow, supported the kitchen, and as the calendar grew, Shipman brought on local musician and Carr's son, Michael Ross, to help with the booking. And there was a fourth Beatle, Shipman said, Steve Jackman, dear friend and architect, who helped design the look of the place, purple walls, cushion seating. We even painted the place ourselves. Sometimes the owners themselves took the stage. Ross recalled, there was this one last open mic night. Harry Tweeting from Harry's Guitar Shop hosted it. It was the only time Jim Bob Kreitz ever took the stage during the Easy Street's entire existence. The two of them played Landslide, and there wasn't a dry eye in the house. It was the most vulnerable I ever saw Kreitz let anyone see him. Together, the group transformed the large East Harget Street building into something Raleigh didn't have enough of at the time, a room built upon live music. Initially, it was conceived as a place where people could sit down, enjoy live music, and have a meal. Blues, jazz, and acoustic formed the early backbone of the calendar before the club gradually expanded into rock, roots, and Americana. Word spread. When Dark Star played Easy Street, said Brown, fans traveled long distances just to attend. The club quickly became a crossroads for musicians and music fans alike. Touring performers mixed with local acts. Friendships formed. Sometimes those encounters became stories. When Dark Star opened for Colonel Bruce Hampton and his Aquarium Rescue Unit, Brown recalled keyboard player Michael Thrower leaving his keyboard case open backstage. Instead of stepping around it, Hampton stepped directly into it. The muddy footprint remained. Brown recalled with a laugh, Michael revered it like an autograph. As Easy Street's reputation grew, so did its network. By then, Ross had joined Shipman in booking acts for the club while writing for the local music magazine, Reel to Reel. After interviewing John Prine following the singer-songwriter's performance on April 1992 in Memorial Auditorium, Ross found himself chatting with Prine aboard the tour bus. Before leaving, he made an offhand invitation. Well, my mom has the club down the street, and I'm the booking agent. You should come by. He didn't expect anything to come of it, but about 30 minutes later, Clea, the doorman, knocked on his office door. Hey, man, there's a big group of people here to see you. It was Prine and his entire band. They showed up for the free beer that had been offered, so I immediately dropped some pitchers on the table. Say, hey, it's open mic night tonight. Why did you sign up on the list? I was joking. But then, I'll be fuckered if Prine didn't walk up and put his name on the list. He played 6 songs that night for what Ross still calls the luckiest people on earth. Everybody made up lies and said they were there. There really wasn't hardly anybody there. It was the open mic crowd. They just happened to get John Prine that night. Easy Street had become exactly the kind of place its founders imagined financially. However, the venue was struggling. Well, and I'm struggling now to keep this broadcast going, but I must stop because my timer is about to run out. John Federson for Indie Week says that this episode will be a podcast after it's broadcast on Friday the 7th. And it goes into the banks, and you can also find the conclusion of this interesting article about Easy Street by going to indieweek.com. They have free archives themselves of the past issues and can find stories from way back. So, for the North Carolina Reading Service, John Federson, for Independent, says so long, and we'll be with you next week.